Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock, joined by Eric Marcotte, where we are coming off UFC 309, the return to Madison Square Garden, the return to Madison Square Garden of Michael Chandler after 2 years away, the return to the octagon of Stipe Miocic after nearly 4 years, the return to the octagon of John Jones, and the return to Madison Square Garden for the Republican Party. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. Eric, how are you today?
I'm doing mighty fine today after, a nice 7 hours of the Republican Party's victory lap.
Don't you feel patriotic today? I mean, don't we feel like proud Americans after watching that commercial throughout most of the night? But somehow we've shifted.
If I didn't before, Michael Chandler's post-fight interview just did it for me. It got me there.
Well, no one wants to hear about politics in sport. They don't want to hear us talk about it, any of that. So, like, how dare we? What a weekend it was in combat sports. We had UFC 309, and kicking the weekend off was another big return, that of Mike Tyson into the ring at the age of 58, in God knows what physical condition, until he alerted us on Saturday of the man nearly dying over the summer. And Texas taking a look, I'm sure, at his medicals, finding, with great scrutiny, believing, we feel confident, in the spirit of sanctioning Dada 5000 to fight a number of years ago. What are 8 blood transfusions? I'm going to let you lead things here. Do you want to go talk about Tyson and Paul first, or UFC 309? What direction shall we go in, Eric?
Let's go in chronological order here. Let's start with Jake Paul and Mike Tyson.
So, Eric, I know you are a bona fide fight connoisseur. Tell me, were you just enamored by the circus spectacle of this? And by Friday afternoon, were you anticipating, what am I going to see tonight? Where was your interest level for this card on Netflix?
My interest level was just beyond zero. I had absolutely zero interest in this fight, and it shocked me. I was about to say, it shocked me that people did, but I think we've seen that if you put the right person with Jake Paul, people are into it, and Mike Tyson is definitely the right person to capture that audience. I don't even know where you want to start with this. I was shocked.
I want to know, first of all,
shock at the result.
I mean, I think there are multiple ways in which people are going to view this. In terms of a live event, you have to look at this like this was enormous. They have announced, we will see if this number holds up to scrutiny, but 72,300. And I mean, visually, this looked full by the time this main event began, surpassing a gate of $18 million, according to Netflix and Most Valuable Promotions. I think in that sense, like this did strike a nerve with the public that were very interested in this fight, that I think it did cross over. And the fact that it being on Netflix just led to so much accessibility. But I think coming.
Go ahead. I genuinely can't recall the last time so many people were talking about a fight, to be honest with you. Maybe like Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor, or Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. That's the level of interest I think this captured, especially among people who don't care about fighting or haven't cared about fighting for 30 years. I think this, the prospect of seeing Mike Tyson come out to fight this annoying YouTube guy in their minds was exactly the type of audience that Netflix was able to get in massive numbers here.
And that ended up being the central issue, was the mass numbers that were trying to access this. So I had got home like Friday night. I had gone to the Raptors game. I came home and I'm tuning in, and this is before the Amanda Serrano, Katie Taylor fight, and I'm planning to watch that and then the main event. And that is from the jump, the streaming issues that I encountered, where it was just, if I could get the stream going, it was heavily pixelated and going in slow motion. And if I tried to fast forward my feed up to the live stream, boom, it crashed without fail. I'm talking probably 15 to 20 times it crashed on me throughout the next hour or so. And I'm switching devices. I'm going from my computer to my TV. Finally, on my phone, which was not great either, I would say the last half of the Tyson-Paul fight, that was the uninterrupted portion that I had. But it was a nightmare to get this streaming. And I'm not one to complain about streaming issues if it's like a relatively small thing. But this was the dominant discussion all night long, and coming out of it was the capacity for Netflix to put on such an event of this magnitude and just buckled under the pressure. Now, did you experience a lot of streaming issues on Friday night?
No, I went back to watch it after the fact.
Smart.
Okay, can you still hear me? Sorry, yes. Having a bit of technical difficulties here. All right, that's fine then. I went back to watch it after the fact. It didn't feel like a must-watch live viewing for me personally. I mean, yeah, keep in mind that Mike Tyson's pretty much entire career ended before I was in elementary school, okay? So he's not exactly like this big nostalgic figure for me.
You came up in the Kevin McBride era of his career by 2005.
Very much so. And he's a huge celebrity, don't get me wrong. It's just, I don't think I had any false ideas of how this fight would play out.
No, I can't say that there was much intrigue for me in terms of the actual fight or who was going to be winning this fight. But like I was genuinely interested to see Netflix pulling off this production and ultimately what this was going to... Like, to me, the story of this was Netflix more than it was even Mike Tyson coming out of retirement. I will say, much like we saw a couple of years ago, Eric, when Triller did the pay-per-view with Tyson and Roy Jones Jr., and it was sort of the same premise of this, like, can you believe these two guys are fighting? And that did a surprisingly great number on pay-per-view. This did an enormous audience. It does tell me that there is an appeal to Mike Tyson that few have ever had when it comes to combat sports, that there is just such an intrigue in this guy and this highlight reel, no matter how many decades old, that people will look back upon and just think this guy can land that punch. And you watch that preview that they put up on Netflix, the 3-episode series, like this is just a super compelling figure in sports. And that crosses over, and it did on Friday night. Like, this was very, like, Jake Paul is not killing it on pay-per-view unless he has a Mike Tyson opposite him. And this was a gigantic success from that perspective. I think you would have had a lot more outrage if people were spending $60, $70 on this pay-per-view. But you still, to me, it was like the streaming issues were the story of this night.
Yeah, and going back to your earlier fact, I think Mike Tyson is just someone who's really captured adults of a certain age group here. I mean, when I talk to a lot of very casual boxing or MMA combat sports fans, you talk to some of these people and they'll just say, yeah, Mike Tyson is the greatest boxer of all time. A lot of people will say that. Now, if you talk to someone who has a stronger knowledge about the history of boxing, Mike Tyson's not on everyone's top 10 heavyweights of all time list, but to that casual audience, he has such a...
He might have the greatest highlight reel of any boxer.
definitely in that conversation. And in 2024, he has a name that I think is only perhaps eclipsed by maybe Muhammad Ali. That's the level of fame that we're talking about here, and it's still cashing in to this day.
And by the end of this, I mean, if you didn't see the fight, I mean, this was just like Mike Tyson was never in this fight in any competitive sense. He landed, I think the final number was 19 punches. This was over 8 2-minute rounds. And I mean, the focus has been on Jake Paul. Did Jake Paul just not turn up the gas on Mike Tyson? Was Jake Paul capable of even going that? I can't say this was a emphatic quote-unquote victory for Jake Paul either, because I can't say like there's a whole lot of interest I have in Jake Paul after this fight, but there will be interest for whatever Jake Paul's next fight. The frightening aspect was after all of this and we got to the finish line and Errol Hawani asking Mike Tyson if this is it for him. And this man is hardly shutting the door and already throwing his promotional muscle into the idea of fighting Logan Paul right there in the ring. I mean, I will. We can say all we want about God. How could they trot this out again? The fact is, if Mike Tyson is fighting at 59 a year from now against Logan Paul, we're going to go through this same thing over again. And it sounds preposterous, but I mean, the audience just seems to just, they have an appetite for Mike Tyson. And if you space it out enough years, people come back for more. And it would be puzzling after watching a contest like Friday night, where this individual should not be in any kind of sanctioned boxing event.
No, definitely not. It seems almost criminal, the fact that he was sanctioned to actually compete here, but the interest would definitely be there. And I do think a big part of that is playing him against the right opponent, someone like Logan Paul, where you can convince people that Mike Tyson's just going to go in there and knock him out. Like, I think back to the Evander Holyfield comeback fight against Vitor Belfort, which is the definition of the wrong opponent, right? Someone sure. who's, you're not going to get a ton of buys, and he's probably going to horribly, horribly hurt the person. You don't really have that with Logan Paul, for example. And it's something that people definitely buy into, even though they saw what Mike Tyson looked like here.
Mike Tyson's statement that came out on Saturday: "This is one of those situations when you lost but still won. I'm grateful for last night. No regrets to get in the ring one last time. I almost died in June. Had 8 blood transfusions, lost half my blood and 25 pounds in hospital, and had to fight to get healthy to fight, so I won. To have my children see me stand toe-to-toe and finish 8 rounds with a talented fighter half my age in front of a packed Dallas Cowboys stadium is an experience that no man has the right to ask for. Thank you." If accurate, this is absolutely insane and just so egregious, even by the standards of the commission in Texas, that this individual was allowed to fight and nearly dying, which, I mean, it was very carefully handled when this occurred over the summer and the fight got delayed, this hospitalization. And then we got more of a glimpse into it in the Countdown series on Netflix, that this man was defecating tar, as he described it, and was asking the physicians at the hospital if he was going to live, and not being given a clear answer. I mean, it's puzzling, but at the same time, I mean, essentially, if you have a pulse, and even if not, there is a fair shot that you could fight in Texas.
Oh, 100%. And if Texas won't do it, someone else will. You could always fight if you go to the right place. And I think there's a lot of commissions that are going to be completely willing to get Mike Tyson in there for that big payday.
Last thing on this, what is Netflix's strategy coming out of this? Like, yes, you certainly have a customer base that I think left pretty unsatisfied because there was such a widespread amount of the streaming issues. I don't think that's a killer, though. Like, we are talking about Netflix here. Their next big undertaking will be the Christmas Day games for the NFL. But like, what is Netflix's strategy specific when it comes to boxing? Will this be a case of, if Jake Paul fights, this might be something of interest to Netflix? Do you see them having a larger appetite for boxing, or even revisiting, if there's only so many fights of this kind of magnitude that come along? It's not like this is going to happen in any kind of frequency.
Exactly that. I can say with near certainty that we will see Netflix do another boxing event at some point. Should we expect them to be frequent or consistent? No, I don't think so. It's going to be when you have something like this, like a Mike Tyson comeback fight, where you can really get that subscriber count up. I think that aside, I don't know if you're going to see Netflix just doing casual Dana White contender series boxing cards out there. Okay, I think they're going to go for the big ones if they can get them. And if they can't get them, they don't care. They're just going to do something else.
Well, there are our thoughts on Friday's, however you want to describe it, debacle, groundswell moment for Jake Paul fans. It was a huge spectacle, and you cannot deny that this became a very massive event, which is ultimately what Netflix is aiming for. But I did find it hilarious in their press release to tout the amount of social activity on Friday night, because all social activity I saw on Friday night, it was it reminded me of the time that they were promoting on a WWE Crown Jewel show that Hulk Hogan is trending on Twitter. And if you saw what Hulk Hogan was trending for in his first appearance back in WWE on a Saudi Arabia show, I don't know if that was as much something you want to be patting yourself on the back for. But there you go. My Jake Paul, he improves to 11-1. So look out, Canelo. He's coming for you.
Is that his actual record at this point? 11-1?
He's 11-1, if
There's
I'm not mistaken.
There's been 12 of these things? Oh, my God. Time is just flying.
From Nate Robinson to Mike Tyson.
Oh, my God, Nate
Robinson. I mean, how many people have the resume that's filtered with two Tyron Woodley fights? Anderson Silva, Nick Diaz, Tommy Fury,
Ben Askren,
of course.
Yeah,
I mean, it's quite the resume, but we will see. I do think Jake Paul makes a whole lot more sense on not a free streaming service, but you understand, away from pay-per-view. Like, I don't think there's an audience in mass that is willing to pay for Jake Paul fights, especially when you don't have an A-side like a Mike Tyson. They will just stream these fights if they're so interested. But on a Netflix, I mean, this is the kind of fighter that I see Netflix wanting to be attached to, because he does go outside of that bubble that Netflix is trying to. Like, I don't think Netflix wants to get into the boxing business. They want to get into the spectacle business. And that's what Jake Paul brings to you.
Definitely. And that is enough on Mike Tyson and Jake Paul for one day.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you two editions of Rewind Away, starting off with a film review of Death Warrior. As described, the 2009 classic features five of the best mixed martial arts champions from around the world forced to play a deadly game. Plus, we tackle TNA's Turning Point from 2009. Karen Peterson and Bruce Lord will be covering the historic Crossover 2 event, plus an Ask Away mailbag show, Rewind to SmackDown, and Collision Course. $6 a month gets you access to the Post Wrestling Cafe.
On to UFC 309, the return to Madison Square Garden, an announced attendance 20,200 and gate of $16.7 million, probably because they gave up like a dozen seats to half the administration that's coming in just a couple of months. And this was all centered around the return of Jon Jones, making his long-awaited return against a man with an even longer departure from the UFC, Stipe Miocic, who... If ever you wanted to emphasize the age of Stipe Miocic, it was when they noted at the beginning of the fight that Stipe Miocic has not fought in front of an arena crowd since August of 2019. Yes, the last time we saw him getting blitzed by Francis Ngannou was in the Apex, which this man has not been around this many people in in 5 years, Eric.
Oh, man. If you want, like, a bit of a morbid one, one that I saw keep flowing around is that Anthony Rumble Johnson has won a fight more recently than Stipe Miocic.
Yeah. I mean, this was one where, I mean, the odds were extremely long. I didn't discount that Stipe Miocic. I mean, this is still a guy. This was an impossible performance to predict, because you have nothing to base it upon. The only factor you can look at is Stipe Miocic is now 42 coming into this fight against the greatest fighter of all time in most people's estimation. And with Jones, you know, we've been limited to one very brief fight with Ciryl Gane in terms of his heavyweight resume. But this week, it was all the discussion ended up being on Tom Aspinall, and is going to be the same conversation coming out of this fight. This was one where, I mean, just from all sides, we are going to deliver this Jones-Miocic fight, even if we have to delay it by a year. And finally, we get here. What was it worth the journey towards this fight that was to determine the greatest heavyweight of all time, Eric? Francis Ngannou.
I remember this time last year when the fight got canceled and they replaced it with Tom Aspinall and Sergey Spivak. And I think the other one was like, it was an Alex Pereira fight, maybe against Jiří Prochazka. And just like
Sergey Pavlovich with.
Sorry. And I was so much more excited for those fights, because I was thinking, wow, you know, Jon Jones, Stipe Miocic, that's a bit of an old man fight. That's. a year later did not help things. I wasn't into this fight at all by this point. And there was a time where I would have been super into this fight. Like, I think it would have been a super compelling matchup, just maybe 5 years ago. But, I wasn't into this. It felt like most MMA fans weren't into this. And it felt like there were certain people promoting this fight who were very upset that people weren't into this.
Well, the fight began with a Miocic that, man, I can't say there was too much of this fight that you would have had any kind of belief in Stipe pulling this out. I mean, he came out and he landed a right-hand counter, and I think that was his window of opportunity in this entire fight, because then Jones starts kicking at the body. His kicks were excellent throughout this fight, and they would be punctuated by the end of this, and it's just breaking down Stipe, and you can see him getting more sluggish as he's absorbing these blows and gets blasted with an elbow after being taken down, and Jones assumes this dominant position, and he is ripping apart Miocic with elbows from half guard. Miocic does recover full guard, and then Jones to side where he lands more elbows. I thought a 10-8 opening round. Like, Jones just decimated him in this first round. It nearly was on the verge of being stopped, and I would not have had that a giant issue. I think had his head been split open as we had seen on the undercard, maybe we would have seen Herb Dean use some discretion here.
A very clear 10-8 round for John Jones. I mean, Stipe looked like he was underwater here. So slow. And I just, he didn't look like an active fighter.
There was not any drama here. We were not going to see a Michael Chandler like burst of energy as this fight would wear on. Miocic is much slower in the second. It's Jones with a counter left, and then boom, with more kicks, lands a knee from the tie clinch, and then Miocic would get like these single shots in, but there was no follow up, no combinations, not really mixing up his shots, and then we start to see Jones executing a spin kick to the body, which he would later state is something that he has been, he specifically got a Thai coach that would come to his home, and he would drill these 3 hours a week from both stances and just try and perfecting these spin kicks. I was wondering if maybe he had incorporated maybe Jushin Thunder Liger tapes to his arsenal here that he was looking at. Jones in the third round, it was a Jones second round, I think, to no one's surprise. And
except
the third round
on one judge's scorecard.
Yeah. Are you joking, or are you?
No, I am serious. Okay. With you, Stipe Miocic won that round on a judge's scorecard.
What?
Yeah.
That's insane. I did not even have the thought to look at scorecards after this to see that someone scored this round for Miocic. I have no idea. The third round, Jones is jabbing away, and then Jones rocks him. He uses a left jab to set up this right hand that lands as clean as can be. Miocic's head got snapped back to Ohio, and they clinch, lands a shoulder strike on the break, and then he goes back to his jabs, lands with a clean left, and then with Miocic's back towards the cage, Jones executes the nastiest looking spin kick that looked like Stipe's ribs were just sent into dust, and he just plummets to the mat and gets finished with strikes at 4:29 of the third round, as John Jones, an emphatic win to improve to 28-1 with one no contest, courtesy of Daniel Cormier, the rematch. And that is it. John Jones looked fantastic in this fight, is the best way I can summarize it. Minus that shaky second round, according to one judge.
See, I don't even know if I fully agree with you on that one. When I was watching John Jones, I thought he looked much better than Stipe Miocic. But even I was kind of looking at John where he seemed a bit slow. He was having trouble getting out of the way of some really slow combinations from Miocic, who was landing whenever he just took a step forward, and then he would give up when John just started running the other way. I thought this was an old man fight. I thought this was a sad old man fight, and Jones was just the better of the two, but by a lot, don't get me wrong. But I did not enjoy this at all. I just thought it was very sad.
I was definitely a lot higher on John Jones' performance than you were. I mean, yes, he is absolutely slower at, you know, 238 pounds, but I just thought he was just in a totally different league than Miocic here. And I don't know if this, I think this is a better indication of John Jones at heavyweight than we got with Ciryl Gane. We got a bit more here, but I think there's still a certain level of like incomplete to this heavyweight career that featured like a blitzing of Ciryl Gane, who had terrible fight IQ, and a 42-year-old Stipe Miocic that I just think was never in this fight at all. But John Jones gets the victory at 429 of the third round. And afterwards, he is indicating that he will... I mean, he said a lot more in the post-fight press conference than he did in the cage with Joe Rogan, where he was more concerned about landing his Donald Trump dance than he was about talking about any future fights. But he made it very clear in the press conference afterwards he wants Alex Pereira, and if he were to fight with Tom Aspinall, he wants, quote, fuck you money, that it wouldn't even matter if he won or lost. Doesn't care for Tom Aspinall because Tom Aspinall has made some t-shirts. And that is his conclusion on Tom Aspinall. But he's willing to fight whenever Dana White wants him to, but he very much wants the Alex Pereira fight. And then we go to Stipe Miocic, and Stipe, is this the end for you? Oh yeah, I'm done. That was it. Like the most Stipe Miocic retirement announcement you could ever envision. This was it. I mean, this guy was. This guy was. Check, please. I'm out of here.
This was the most fitting end to Stipe Miocic possible. He's given the mic for half a second. Hey, Stipe, do you think this is it? Yep. Thank God. And then he leaves, and I'm sure we will never hear from him again.
I think that we are, like, we may never see him again. I don't even know if he shows.
Probably it.
Like, he is known at times to be in the crowd for some of these events. I don't know if we'll ever see him at an event. Maybe he does a Hall of Fame thing, but yeah, this is, we talk about how fast the fan base moves on from the next generation of stars, and I think Stipe will be more than happy to just fade into the memories of those that were around for this time period, because I do not see this man. I do not see this man launching his own podcast, is my prediction.
No, I don't think that's in the cards for one Stipe Miocic. I've always been very entertained by his complete disinterest in doing any media, really.
Where and what do you want to see John Jones do next? Because he has the options on the table that he has presented are: pay me so much money that I can't say no to fighting Tom Aspinall, Alex Pereira, which is his preferred choice, and the third being that he's not even dismissing, like, he would be more than happy to walk away on this kind of a note, because it was the finish and getting to fight in front of the president that were enough for him to call this a career.
Honestly, I think this would be a really good retirement for John Jones. Now, I fully expect him to come back and fight again, but he's 37 years old. He's had some serious surgeries. And like I said, I didn't think he looked spectacular here. I think this was a great finish for Jones himself to just be like, okay, I went in there. I won and defended the heavyweight title against a huge name in Stipe Miocic, and a fine retirement. If he is fighting again, I would love to see the Aspinall fight. I think that's the one most people are interested in. And I think intentional or unintentional, it's always tough to say with Mr. Jones, but I think he's done a great job of building the fight up. So
if he's so adamant about the Alex Pereira fight and it's just an easier fight to make, do you just bite the bullet if you're the UFC and just put this fight on with Pereira? No one is going to be, yes, there will be the initial outrage that he's not fighting Tom Aspinall, but that's still a huge fight. And do you just bite the bullet and go with that fight and you crown Tom Aspinall your undisputed champion?
Honestly, just from the promoter's standpoint, I would look at Alex Pereira as someone who's probably a bigger star than John Jones right now, but someone who would probably lose very decisively if he were to fight John Jones. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go anywhere near that fight.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not getting the big, like, unification match with Tom Aspinall, and you're looking at John Jones, who could be one fight away from retiring, and we're going to have him very realistically have a chance to defeat one of our, if not biggest star in Alex Pereira, you know, it's a very pro John Jones side of the negotiation if he were to carve that out for himself. I think you make it worth his while to do this Tom Aspinall fight that it seems everybody is clamoring for. And just strategically for the UFC, I think it's a more preferred fight than Alex Pereira, who I don't think he would be favored against John Jones.
No, not at all. I don't see any version of that fight playing out where Jones doesn't just take him down and do a lot of damage.
Next was the rematch between Michael Chandler and Charles Oliveira. 5 rounds at lightweight. A rematch from UFC 261, if I'm not mistaken, back in May of 2021. A fight that Michael Chandler looked great for the first round and then got blitzed and finished in the second. This one going the full 5 rounds, and I will say I thought a spectacular performance from Charles Oliveira. We will remain to see if Eric was in agreement with me or not on that performance. But man, this was Charles Oliveira just making it his fight. This guy was so calm coming out and then starts with a double leg and trips Chandler and takes him down and just gets on top of him for the whole rest of the round, and Chandler is totally mitigated on his back. I mean, he just can't do anything in this first round. The second we go in, and Oliveira rocks him with this right, and Chandler starts to retreat. Like, he's literally running away from Oliveira, who lands another right, then throws a head kick, and Chandler leaps at him with this left, and he's throwing these power shots, but gets taken down, and Oliveira mounts him and starts destroying him with elbows and just dominates this round. This was on the border for me of being a 10-8. I went 10-9 for Oliveira. The third round, not so much. I thought this crossed the threshold for a 10-8 round because it's Oliveira that is early on, nails this nasty right uppercut and it's jumping knee. He ends up powering Chandler to the ground, gets the body triangle, and he's trying for this neck crank as Chandler escapes, but he is totally just submerged in Charles Oliveira throughout the round. Into the fourth we go, another round here for Charles Oliveira as he gets the back, takes him down by the fence, and he's trying for the choke without his hooks in, and then gets the body triangle applied before the end of the round. So Oliveira well ahead on the scorecards. Was the same judge that gave Miocic round two present in this fight, Eric?
You know what? I don't think so. I think this was about as cut and dry as it gets.
Okay. I
would have said the same thing about the main event, to be fair.
I'm hoping no one had it 2-2 going into this fifth round. But the fifth round is where Chandler does look his best because he cracks Charles Oliveira with a right hand and follows up with two big shots, and Oliveira is shooting for the takedown, and Chandler stops him, nails him with these huge shots, many to the back of the head, which have not been legalized along with the 12-6 elbows. But you know what? We were having a wide discretion here exercised by Keith Peterson. Chandler ends up in the guard and eventually lets Oliveira back up to his feet because this is Chandler's best path to victory because he needs a finish. He lands with the left hand and Oliveira takes the back, gets him down. And in the end, Chandler has Oliveira in a backpack position, gets up to his feet, slams him down, which was only going to make this a worse position for him, but it was crowd pleasing. Then this guy powers himself up a second time to his feet. Like, this is ungodly power to be showing this late in a
24th minute of the fight. My God.
Like, this was such a perfect encapsulation of Michael Chandler. Like, this was in no way going to enhance your ability to win this fight, but goddamn was it entertaining. And that's what he did, slamming him a second time. So Chandler does win the fifth round, and I had it 49-45. I gave the third round 10-8 to Oliveira, and scores were 49-46 twice and 49-45 for Charles Oliveira, who just turned in a fantastic performance. And with Michael Chandler, this guy is not going to fight for a lightweight championship. I put the asterisk next to that there could always be an injury, and it would not surprise me if this guy got the emergency phone call, but he's just going to be booked in crowd-pleasing, entertaining fights as long as he wants to continue. But at 38, I thought this was kind of make or break. If this guy had any hopes of fighting for a championship again, I don't think that's going to be in the cards for him, but you could argue he came out just as popular, if not more, than he came into this fight, because he is You know, he was like the star of the post fight too, because he got on the mic and he just lined up a next the next year of fights that he wants to have.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start with all this. This was just a phenomenal fight. Very, you know, largely a dominant performance for Charles Oliveira, who, I mean, even when he got rocked and dropped in the fifth round, I was never concerned that he was on his way to losing this fight, because it just feels like part of the Charles Oliveira experience at this point. You know he's going to get brutally rocked and eat some heavy ground and pound, and you know he's probably going to recover and come back in like a minute's time. So you get used to that. But a great performance from him, far less competitive than the first fight, but Michael Chandler hits so hard, and Charles Oliveira is so there to be hit, that my attention was never lost here. I thought this was so much fun. Yeah, Michael Chandler, probably never going to fight for a title. I'm pretty sure he has a losing record in the UFC. It doesn't really matter. The guy is here to entertain, and he does that every single time.
2-4 in the UFC is Michael Chandler.
And with two losses now to Mr. Oliveira, I don't know if this win does anything for Charles Oliveira, but, you know, he's a remarkably entertaining fighter in his own right and one of the absolute best in the world. So it wouldn't shock me if they do end up sliding him in for another title shot soon.
It appears to be Islam Makhachev and Arman Tsarukyan in January. So, I mean, timing wise, if one of them turns around quick, Oliveira would certainly be, I would say, on the short list to fight again. I don't know. It's one thing to look this great against Michael Chandler in a potential rematch with Islam Makhachev. I don't know. That's a very tough fight for Charles Oliveira.
Harder to sell that one, but if Arman Tsarukyan is the one who gets his hand raised, I mean, Charles Oliveira almost beat him not long ago, so you could easily sell that rematch.
A great fight, and this was given the fight of the night bonus that they received.
Yeah,
and,
shocking.
And yes, Michael Chandler calling out Max Holloway and Conor McGregor as well, which the timeline now, as the man is involved in a civil trial at the moment, Dana White stating Conor will come back late 2025, which, I mean, could literally mean anything. I would put no stock into any.
Yeah, zero stock in that.
Yeah, I just have, I refuse to engage in any Conor McGregor speculation. Paul Craig against Bo Nickel. What a fight this was, for the audience at Madison Square Garden. So Bo Nickel coming into this, a -1200 favorite. These odds were so crazy all week that, earlier in the night, there was a graphic the UFC put up and it listed Paul Craig as a +7050 underdog. And I totally bought this was legit as well when I saw this. I was like, maybe the odds have swung to such a degree that this is how much Paul Craig is. He was a +750 underdog. And but yes, even the broadcast, they saw +7050 underdog, which would have been, I would have, I'm not a gambler, but maybe.
Oh, money's going down. Money's going down.
I would have taken a flyer on Paul Craig here against your -1200 favorite, 6-0, Bo Nickel, who was, another person, just extremely excited to be performing in front of the, president of the United States. So, I mean, this fight and in particular Bo Nickel received a lot of scrutiny. I'm curious to hear what Eric thought about this. You know, the first round was an exceptionally close one. Like, Nickel was shifting stances, going for the body, and aiming with low kicks. And then you would have Paul Craig that would be getting through with his right hand and Nickel firing back at the end of the round. The second round, a better one for Bo Nickel, at least a clearer one, I thought, for him. He cracked him with a left hand as they're entering the final minute, and Paul Craig ends up utilizing his jab that got through, and then Craig is kicking away at the arms of Bo Nickel, and they're starting to discolor the arms. Nickel lands another left and then lands one more at the horn. And then we go into the third round, and this is where the crowd starts chanting overrated at Bo Nickel, who continues forward, nails him with this overhand left that stuns and cuts Paul Craig. It's the most significant shot of the entire fight. But between the chance of overrated was a crowd that was heavily booing this performance by Bo Nickel. And in the end, Bo Nickel wins by unanimous decision against Paul Craig, former light heavyweight Paul Craig. I was not as down on Bo Nickel's performance as many people were. I can see a certain pumping of the brakes when we were hearing Bo Nickel being thrown out for fighting like top five guys at middleweight, fighting Khamzat Chimaev, much less a title fight. But for a guy that this was his seventh pro fight, he got 15 minutes in against a converted light heavyweight. I thought his performance was totally like respectable. I was not as down on this fight as many people were, but this was not a barn burner either.
I thought from an individual standpoint, his performance was fine. He got to clock in some time against a veteran here in Paul Craig, work on his striking, which obviously isn't as refined as his wrestling.
He got a lot of valuable tape out of this, going 15 minutes. And for, you know, your seventh pro fight, like Paul Craig is a really quality opponent. And Bo Nickel won 15 minutes without you needing any wrestling, not needing any of his specialty in this either. Like, he won this fight striking.
Definitely. I think this is definitely going to be a positive for his career in the long run. At the same time, I can tell you, with like about 2 minutes and 30 seconds left in the final round, I was drafting up how I was going to tell you that I don't like MMA anymore, and I didn't want to do podcasts, but I never want to see a 15-minute Paul Craig striking match, okay? Especially on one of the biggest pay-per-views of the year. The fight preceding this did nothing to increase my enjoyment of this one.
Oh, we'll get to Karina Silva.
I just wanted to teleport Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler into the octagon.
Well, in some ways, I think this is the best outcome for Bo Nickel in that he won the fight. He got his 15 minutes in there with Paul Craig, but it was enough that I don't see them if he came out and blitzed Paul Craig, the amount of expectation for where he would be booked next at middleweight is probably not where he should be. Like, they are not slow rolling Bo Nickel, but they're also not throwing him into the deep end. And I think that's probably long term the best for Bo Nickel, that could use some more fights along this pathway before he is sent in against the real killers of the division.
Oh, yeah. If he just went in there and knocked out Paul Craig in 30 seconds, he'd be fighting Israel Adesanya in like 2 months. Okay?
Yeah.
So I think this was definitely good for him in every conceivable way, honestly.
Eric's fight of the night was the women's flyweight bout between ninth-ranked Viviane Araújo and Karina Silva, who was a minus 300 favorite. And first round, Silva is landing these looping strikes, but a lot of movement by Araújo getting out of the pocket. And then a left hand lands for Silva, and she follows with a right in the last minute, the best strikes of this round. Second round, Araújo's nose has somehow been just shattered open here, so she's got like blood all over her face. Silva lands with a front kick and cracks her with multiple rights, and then it's Araújo who is just grabbing the fence to avoid the takedown. A lot of fence grabbing on this particular night. Silva gets the body lock takedown, and then Araújo threatens with the armbar. Silva defends, gets the side control, and tried unsuccessfully with a darce. After two rounds, how had you scored this fight, and were you still awake?
I was staying in there. I think I was like the one person who saw both of the first two rounds for Silva. I just thought she was
landing. No, you weren't. I scored the first two for Silva.
Hey, John, how's it going? That's great. Okay. Yeah. I thought she was just
I didn't even think it was all that
run.
Close. Like, I was kind of blown away afterwards.
I feel better now. I feel a lot better now. I just thought she was landing way heavier shots and was a bit surprised that Araújo got her arm raised.
I'm not saying these rounds were blowouts, but I thought they were fairly straightforward to score. Yeah. I had Silva winning both these rounds. So the third round, I don't know what happened to Karina Silva in between rounds two and three, but all of a sudden she was Antonio Inoki for 5 minutes in this round, just flopping to her back, just had nothing left. And Araújo is waving her up. Mark Goddard is standing her up. Like, she just would not engage. And that just gave free rein for Rogan and Cormier to just go at, like, what does it say about her conditioning, much less fighting for a title in the future? I mean, they just destroyed Karina Silva for these final 5 minutes. At the end, I'm like, okay, awful third round for Silva, but it's a 29-28 win for her. No, all three judges went 29-28 for Viviane Araújo, and I was very surprised. This was the for all the times that we look at the judging, I thought tonight's card there were some close fights and such. I thought the judges like nailed it on this night, this being the one exception.
Round two, Stipe Miocic.
Okay. I did not know that until you informed me about 20 minutes ago of that. That's insane. That, like, that is the most egregious score turned in tonight that I'm aware of. Like, that is insane beyond this fight.
No, I agree. I thought the judging was fine on this card, but yeah, I was with you. I saw this one for Silva. I mean, I just thought she did the better work throughout the first two rounds. I suppose they gave it to Arujo the second round based on her submission attempts, but it wasn't as though Silva didn't have any submission attempts of her own in that round. Plus, I thought she did more damage. So, I mean, I thought it was fairly clear, but I'm not going to lie to you also. Like, I don't care. I don't care at all.
Let's just say that Dana White spoke to the media for 36 minutes afterwards, and the name Vivian Araújo never came up, nor Karina Silva. So I don't know what that tells you about a main card fight on this pay-per-view, but it happened, and Araújo won, and we moved on. Mauricio Rufi versus Hamish Yontop. Don't call him James. This was supposed to be at lightweight, then was made into a 165-pound catchweight bout, and Yontop managed to miss the catchweight by 1.2 pounds. So he comes into this a plus 600 underdog, eliminating himself from a bonus contention. But to his credit, he put forth a great performance here and took a ton of damage. Maybe his orbital bone was shattered in this fight, quite possibly. And it was all the more compounded by the fact that his eye was swelling to such a degree on top of his Uzi of a tattoo he has on said eye.
Yeah, quite the look, honestly. You know what? It was a very solid performance from Rufi here. I thought he showcased some pretty cool striking. Definitely woke up the crowd at some points with some of his creative shots. It got a bit tired by that third round, and Yontop was able to mount a bit of a comeback there, but just couldn't quite do enough to force a finish. A fine opener. I mean, it was fine. Like, I think we've really been spoiled with some of these MSG cards these last few years, and some of these fights just weren't ones that you would expect from what has traditionally been one of the biggest UFC cards of the calendar year.
Well, I don't know why everyone keeps hammering everybody about when is Conor McGregor coming back. I mean, you got Mauricio Rufi here.
Oh, they were really pushing that on commentary. Like, oh, look at his stance. That's the Conor McGregor stance. I think that's where the comparisons end. But they, Joe Rogan and Daniel Cormier were really into that.
Yeah, I mean, Rufi won the first two rounds. I mean, he packed a ton of power, and to his credit, Yontop took a ton of damage here. And then the third round, Yontop won the third round using a lot of inside low kicks, and Rufi just slowed down. I mean, he puts a lot of he just puts so much into his striking, and he was not ready for three full rounds here, and 29-28 for Mauricio Rufi, who improves to 11-1. But he was a minus 900 favorite, and I wouldn't say this was he called up Benoit Saint-Denis afterwards.
That was like the story of the main card, honestly. Like, every single fight other than Michael Chandler versus Charles Oliveira, which Oliveira was still a sizable favorite and had a massive favorite against a massive underdog. I think that's kind of why I was so disinterested in this card. There wasn't interesting matchups.
Well, let's kind of just blitz through the undercard with some of the highlights here. Jonathan Martinez took on Marcus McGee. Marcus McGee, who they were just blown away that this man competes at bantamweight. He was just gigantic for the weight class. Similar story here. Like, McGee won the first two rounds, and Jonathan Martinez, for all the talk about John Jones' fight IQ, this was the polar opposite. Like, Jonathan Martinez, it almost felt like he was, how can I lose this fight? And in the third round, he is going for the leg kick, and McGee responds, lands his own combination. And so at the end of the second round, Martinez had been landing these leg kicks, and McGee, right at the end of the round, he is limping to his corner. And it wasn't enough for Martinez to win the second round on my card, but the third round, like, there was a very clear target for Martinez, and you think he's going to go after it. And he hits this leg kick, and McGee can't even stand on this leg. So what do you do when you're facing a one-legged man? You clinch against the fence, And I was just blown away. Like, you could very realistically end this fight and prove Cecil Peoples wrong. But instead, Martinez just clinched him. And yeah, you won the round, but you lost the fight 29-28. And it was just a puzzling decision by Jonathan Martinez, who essentially beat himself in this fight. Cause I just thought McGee is not going to make it to the end of this round. Like, his leg was shot by the end of the second.
This was an uncharacteristic performance from Jonathan Martinez, who's typically a very, he's a very good fighter, honestly, very good. But he was off here. He was off for the entire fight, and you can tell from the very beginning. And the commentators are speculating perhaps that was, you know, as a result of his last fight, where he did get beaten fairly decisively by a possibly 45-year-old Jose Aldo. And
maybe Aldo told him afterwards, he's like, you know what? Leg kicks really overrated. That's why I don't do them anymore.
I mean, that's impossible, doesn't it?
But, I'll take those out now. Yeah, if a guy's limping, it's just a tell. Don't buy it. Don't put any stock into it. That's the time to clinch.
A good win for McGee, but Martinez is definitely a better fighter than he showed here.
Yeah, sometimes it's like instead of a fighter winning, it's the other fighter that lost the fight, and that felt like this one with Jonathan Martinez. Jim Miller.
Oh, damn.
Versus Damon Jackson. All right. This was Jim Miller, who already holds the record for most fights and most wins in the UFC, and manages to extend both those numbers by one after absorbing some front kicks. And then Damon Jackson, taken from the Jonathan Martinez school, dives in and pretty much gives Jim Miller his neck on a platter, and Jim Miller squeezes on this guillotine as he takes him down to the mat, and Damon Jackson submits at 244 of the first round, and Jim Miller, at the age of 41, wins in his 56th pro fight. And noting the fact that he has now had 45 fights in UFC history, he wants to fight to at least 50, and I mean, this man just continues to defy logic. He has now won three of his last four. Yes, he is fighting a certain level of talent, but I don't care that, like, this guy is still, you know, your Gabriel Benitez's and Damon Jackson's of the world is fine for a Jim Miller to be fighting. And then gave his his very nonpartisan post-fight speech that even Joe Rogan felt like, let's cool it down on the politics, was kind of Joe Rogan's response here, which was comical.
This was just, it's remarkable to see Jim Miller still coming out here and getting wins this deep into his career. And like you said, it's at a level, but they're not layups either. It's not
at all.
Like, they're not picking guys out of the regional scene for him to get wins on. These are like legitimate UFC level guys. He's still going in there and he's beating on a fairly consistent basis. A really impressive win for Jim Miller, and I think it's fitting that Jim Miller and Charles Oliveira both picked up wins here on the same card, because those are the two men who are competing for basically every single promotional record.
And then Damon Jackson also retired after this fight, and
Damon and Stipe
declined an interview as well, which, I mean, maybe Stipe was watching this like, wait, I can decline an interview. David Onama against Roberto Romero. This was a very late acceptance of this fight by Roberto Romero, who stepped in just this past week. I think he only got into New York, they mentioned, on Thursday, and represents Team Oyama. So we had Oyama versus Onama in this fight, Eric.
Yes, very well done.
Okay. Listen, Roberto Romero, he came out, he looked tremendous in this first round. I mean, this guy was putting a ton of pressure on Onama, and Onama threatened with an anaconda but lost it on the feet, and Romero gets back on target, had a lot of success with his right hand, and then it's Onama returning fire and put Romero onto the mat and ended with a flurry. It was a great end to the round for Onama, but I thought that Romero still squeaked by. This was an excellent round in the first.
Yeah, if not for Chandler Oliveira, I think this was well on its way to winning fight of the night. And just say, when I spoke earlier about some of like the wide odds on this one, Onama was a -1350 favorite. Like, this was not expected to be a competitive fight at all. At the same token, why was he a -1350 favorite? I'm not sure. Those were wild, wild odds.
Well, I didn't think he won the first round. Like, he made it close, but I thought Romero won the first. The second, Onama gets hit with a spinning elbow, and he's placed on his back, and then Romero gets put on his back, and Onama enters his guard, and Onama ends up winning with just after landing this solid left hook early on, and turns things around. And the third, he increases his combinations, worked with the jab, and then Romero just seemed to tire by the first round, which I think was evident in some of these, like, especially lighter weight fights where you see guys take it on such short notice. Is like, you can have a good round, but man, he put a lot into that first, and I think the after effects really kind of showed themselves in round three. Onama takes him against the fence, mounted him, and then works in the guard and landed some very big elbows and hammer fists at the end. David Onama wins by unanimous decision. All three judges gave all three rounds to him, which the first was close. I did have it 29-28 for Onama, but he gets a win, but hardly a blowout as these odds might have thought.
I had the exact same scorecard as you, and it was a really fun fight. I think a very good showing for Roberto Romero, considering the circumstances here.
You can't say fun fight without mentioning Marcin Tybura, one of Eric's favorites, of his favorite cottage industry of MMA, that being non-title heavyweight MMA. And he was taking on Jonata Geniz, undefeated fighter, and much closer odds. So I'm sure you were very excited about this, because Tybura coming off another one of your favorites, a submission loss to Sergey Spivak back in August. So Geniz throws a head kick early on and stuns Tybura, who comes back with a left hand and gets on top of him. And Tybura's grabbing at the wrist, then sweeps him, but eats hammer fists in the process. And then Tybura gets on top of him and just starts unloading elbows as he gets to mount. This was not a good time for Geniz, and the violence continued in the second. They trade on their feet, and Tybura takes him down into half guard, and you have never seen a man give less resistance to a man mounting him than Geniz, who just had no idea of how to defend. And Tybura starts pounding him with these elbows, and his head explodes. I'm not even using hyperbole here. His head was just so damaged. This was a 10-8 round, and such that the doctor stopped this fight in between rounds, and Marcin Tybura gets the win by TKO. Do we have a left field choice for John Jones after this victory by Marcin Tybura, now 26-9?
Listen, Marcin Tybura would have given him a better fight than Stipe Miocic did. I'll give him that much. Which is the most depressing thing I've ever said. Marcin Tybura, man, this guy is just, he showed up 8 years ago and he's fought like 21 times since then. And you know exactly what to expect with this guy. Okay. I don't think I've ever predicted a Marcin Tybura fight wrong. You know exactly who he's going to beat and exactly who he's going to lose to. You get exactly what you think you will get with that man. And that's all I can say. That's all I have to say.
Ramiz Brahimi made quick work of Mickey Gall, who was a 500 fighter in the UFC coming into this, losing his fourth fight in a row. Brahimi, very loose at the beginning. Gall was trying to get his jab going. There was a good clinch here from Brahimi, and then lands uppercuts and used this left jab to set up a head kick. And then after Gall eats this combo, he tries to throw one of his own, and in response just gets dropped and finished against the fence. 255 of the first round. Ramiz Brahimi gets a performance of the night bonus, and with Mickey Gall losing four in a row, which goes all the way back to 2021, this guy missed 2 years of his career. You have to wonder if this is it for Mickey Gall.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to expect from him.
Though on a roster of like 700 fighters, I don't know. It used to always be four losses in a row would be it. But now everyone, I mean, this guy could headline an Apex card.
He has a name from the like CM Punk and Sage Northcutt fights. So you can always just throw him in there somewhere. I don't know. I'm like, this isn't high.
Come on, give me that deep analysis of this.
Brahima, it was a really good knockout. Okay. I think that was your takeaway from this one. I don't know. I don't really care about this. This is tough to talk about, honestly.
Well, we'll move on. Oban Elliott knocked out Basil Basil Hafez at 40 seconds of the third round. Very close first round. Second, Elliott was just piling up body and leg kicks, and Hafez having a lot of trouble just getting his shots over. And then in the third, it's Elliott who drops him with a right hand and proceeded to hit a pair of punches, which might have knocked out Hafez and then woken him up. So just for good measure, nailed him with six hammer fists until Mark Goddard was like, I think this one's over. So Obon Elliott gets the victory in the third round. He has now won eight in a row, and this was his third win of 2024. Look good here at welterweight. Fine undercard fight. Did this meet the Eric Marcotte level of approval for a early and prelim bout?
Yeah, it did. I thought it was a fine fight and a decent performance here from Obon Elliott, complete with a strong finish there in the third round. There wasn't a ton of finishes as this card wore on, so you really had to savor these early ones.
No, and if you were tuning in early, if you had tuned in at 6 o'clock when this was supposed to start, you would have learned that Chris Weidman was removed from the card after his opponent, Eric Anders, came down with a medical issue. Both men had weighed in on Friday, so that fight was scrapped. Chris Weidman did post a video. I mean, it did terrible. For a guy at 40, Chris Weidman doesn't have too many fights left. And, man, you did your whole camp. You know Chris Weidman probably was on the brink of death for his weight cut, as per usual, and doesn't get a fight at the end of it. I mean, pretty tough pill to swallow. So that fight was removed at the last minute. So opening things up was Veronica Hardy and Eduardo Mura, with Mura winning by unanimous decision. I had it 29-28 for Mura winning the first two, and Hardy the third. The highlight of this fight being Joe Rogan just non sequitur. What happened with switching to the old gloves? What's going on? And basically, Cormier gave out all his theories, and then John Anik explains to us that the old gloves are going to be used for the rest of the pay-per-view cards this year, meaning one more card, and the fight night cards will incorporate the new gloves, which are now becoming the old gloves, because the old gloves are now becoming the new gloves. And then at the end of the year, we'll make a determining factor on the new gloves versus the old gloves. Thank you, UFC, for making things as clear and simple to process as possible.
This actually just like insanity. I mean, what's wrong with these people? Maybe they should just do like one glove on one hand and the other one on the other. I don't know. A tribute to Art Jimerson, perhaps.
Yeah. I only have so much real estate in my body to care about certain things. The gloves do not reach the surface of me. I don't care what gloves are used. Let's just do bare knuckle. Mora gets the win. That opened up the card. And that was UFC 309. I think largely built around your top three fights on this card. I would say Chandler and Oliveira, excellent fight. And if you want to also check out the fight between David Onama and Roberto Romero, I thought those were the top two fights of the card. Some good performances, some blasé performances. I wouldn't say this was a thumbs up card overall. It did have the feel, like, for whatever your political leanings aside, like, this did have the feel of like a giant event with just the whole spectacle of the night. It's Madison Square Garden. You know, you had half the administration showing up for this, including RFK Jr. I mean, how much bigger could you get here? But there you go.
It definitely felt like a big event, a big MMA event. I'm not so sure, but
not quite. This did feel closer to a rally by the end of the night. But hey, any night you get Kid Rock in attendance, you know, it's a big one. So there you have it. Eric, any final thoughts on this card? Was this 7 hours well spent?
No, I didn't enjoy this card at all. I didn't think it was particularly interesting. There was a lot of kind of low-level fights that you would expect from, I don't know, an Apex card. I think Michael Chandler and Charles Oliveira did a lot of heavy lifting in terms of quality. And, of course, the star power of John Jones, Stipe Miocic, and Donald Trump, your main eventers. I'm probably never going to think about this card again.
That's the kind of concise analysis I always want out of Eric. Will you be, you know, next weekend they're in China, in Macau. This is like prime time for you, given your
schedule.
Yeah,
it is.
6 a.m. Eastern start time next Saturday with Piotr Jan and Deivison Figueiredo, which I think is a really great, like, that's a perfect quality fight night main event. And, Jan Xiaonan against Tabitha Ricci, second from the top. Interest may vary the deeper you go on this card. With all due respect to, Ozzie Diaz and, Carlos Ulberg. But a very solid main event, I would say, coming to China next weekend.
Yeah, this is pretty solid. Piotr Jan and Figueiredo is, of course, that's a phenomenal main event. Phenomenal main event. But the deeper you go down, I mean, you got like Muslim Salik, obviously. He must be like 40 years old. Whatever, he's here. Volkan Ozdemir and Carlos Ulberg. I'm pretty into this.
And the next time we're going to be back is after UFC 310, which happens December 7th, the final pay-per-view of the year, T-Mobile Arena in Vegas, headlined, at least as of now, by Alexandra Pantoja, defending the flyweight championship against the debuting Kai Asakura. As well, Shavkat Rakhmonov no longer fighting Bilal Muhammad. Instead, he will have a 5-round contest with Ian Machado Gary. Also being featured on this card, Nick Diaz is out, so Themba Gormbo will be facing Vicente Luque. We have Cyril Gane back, taking on Alexander Volkov. Movsar Evloev against Aljamain Sterling. Nate Landwehr against Duho Choi. And Anthony Smith and Dominic Reyes, sure. Michael Chiesa against Max Griffin. And Clay Guida against Chase Hooper, which is as close to like father versus son as you could envision visually. This is a wacky card, but there's a lot of... Krohn Gracie and Bryce Mitchell have been added.
I cannot believe it. They said it on the broadcast, Krohn Gracie, and I almost fell out of my seat. That's just a name I never thought I'd hear again.
Yeah, this guy has had one fight since 2019, and it was a decision loss to Charles Jourdain at UFC 298. I mean,
and let me tell you, it was one of those performances where you watched it and you said to yourself, "Yeah, Krohn Gracie's never fighting again." So,
he's back.
Here we are.
He's back.
I don't know about you, but I think this is actually a decent card.
This doesn't have that one fight that is going to be, you know, your the big fight to like carry this promotionally. But in terms of a card, this is an Eric Marcotte card that I think by the end of this card, I think you will be thoroughly entertained. There's a lot of great stuff on the show. If it stays intact, and I say that with 3 weeks to go, this card has been hit with a lot. I have no anger or disappointment that Nick Diaz is off this card. I don't know what is going on with Nick Diaz, but my interest in seeing him fight is zero.
Yeah, I'm with you. I see that as an addition by subtraction. I didn't want to see that at all, and I just see a lot of fun matchups on here. Listen, you're not gonna draw a huge pay-per-view amount with Alexander Pantoja and Kai Sakura headlining. Okay, we can all agree on that, but it's the kind of fight that I'm into. I think Pantoja might actually fuck him up if I'm being real here, but it remains to be seen. Shavkat Rakhmonov versus Ian Gary is a pretty good fight on short notice there. If there's a single fight here that doesn't really do it for me of your big ones, it's Gane and Volkov, simply because we've already seen that fight and it was extremely one-sided, like one of the most one-sided 5-round fights that you will watch. So I don't really completely understand why they're running that one back in particular, but that aside, really good stuff here.
Anytime you can recreate a Apex main event from a fight night from several years ago, you take that opportunity.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, that's going to wrap things up. So I want to thank everyone for tuning in for our review of UFC 309. Eric Marcotte, the great one, always making time for us once a month for these shows, even when his video is not cooperating with him. But we thank you very much, Eric. We're back on December the 8th, so circle your calendar. Coming up today on the Post Wrestling Cafe, Karen Peterson and Bruce Lord will have a review of Historic Crossover 2. And then tonight, the NWA podcast coming your way with Nate Milton, Chris Ely, Andrew Thompson, and Two-Way Ray. So check out all of that over at postwrestling.com. Eric, have you made the navigation to Blue Sky, or are you X till you die?
You know what? I need to wait like 2 months, okay? Because
That's a good wait period, because yeah. Blue Sky could be the latest flash in the pan. That's
exactly. Awesome. I'm looking at this like, is this just going to be like the next Threads, where it's like, I don't want to get involved with this. I have an image to maintain of someone who only associates with successful social media platforms. So.
Yes.
But I'll wait and see.
You're the bandwagon jumper. So anyway, it remains to be seen. All right. That's it for us. Thanks for tuning in, and we will speak with you after UFC 310.